wasn't going to do it with a perfect record.
Hang on!
But Benedict couldn't hang on. His hand slipped from Quentin's, and he fell back down among the shades without a word. Then they were flying up past the fluorescent lights, and then up through where the ceiling would have been. There was nothing more he could do. Without Benedict to hang on to, Quentin gripped the key so hard it bit into his palm. He had lost Benedict, but he wasn't going to lose that. They rose up into the darkness, through fire, through earth, through water, and then out into the light again. Chapter 25. Before they did it, they took a vacation. It would take a week to order some of the necessary materials, mistletoe, more mirrors, some iron tools, chemically pure water, a few exotic powders. The ritual was pretty involved, more so than Julia would have thought, given the source. She'd expected something crude and pagan, a brute force play, but the reality was more complex and technical than that. They would have to clear a lot of space. So while they waited for the FedEx guy to arrive, and for a few slow-rolling preparatory spells to mature, the magicians of Mur, the secret genius aspirants to the sacred mysteries of the Godhead, played tourist. It was the final furlough before their unit shipped out overseas, some last-minute R&R. They went to Sainonk Abbey, which despite being familiar from a million advertisements and in-flight magazines and 500-piece jigsaw puzzles, was stunningly beautiful, the oldest, stillest place Julia had ever been. They went to Châteauneuf-du-Pape, which really had been the Pope's new castle at some point, though all that was left of it now was a single scrap of wall with a few empty windows in it that stood out above the flat vineyards around it like an old rotten tooth. They drove down to Cassy. It was October, the ass end of the season, and Cassy was the ass end of the Côte d'Azur. Barely part of it at all, low rent and chock-full of teenage day-trippers out of Marseille. But the sun was hot, and the water, while it was colder than Julia thought water could be and still remain in liquid form, was a legitimate and spectacular azure. There was a small hotel there, not far from the beach, in a grove of stone pines full of invisible cicadas that trilled incessantly and amazingly loudly. When they sat on the porch, they could barely hear each other talk. They drank the local rosé, which supposedly lost its flavor if you drank it anywhere besides Cassy, and took a boat tour of the Calanque, the hull-shredding limestone fingers that stuck out into the sea all along the coast. Nobody noticed the magicians. Nobody looked at them twice. Julia felt wonderfully normal. The beaches were all pebbles, no sand, but they spread out their towels over them and did their best to get comfortable, alternating long stretches of sunbathing with terrified, hilarious dashes into the water. It was so freezing it felt like it would stop your heart. They all looked pale in their swimsuits. Following the local custom, Asmodeus took off her top, and Julia thought Falstaff's heart would stop just from that. And it wasn't just Asmodeus's breasts, which were indeed small and high and remarkably jiggly. Falstaff was obviously in love with Asmodeus. 6 months in a house with them, and how the hell had Julia missed that? These were her friends, the closest thing she had to a family now. All this business about being gods was impairing Julia's ability to think like a human, which was never her strong suit to begin with. She'd have to watch that. Something was getting lost in translation. Julia watched the sea foam draw webs and Hebrew letters on the surface of the water and then erase them again. She shook her head and closed her eyes against the hot, white Mediterranean sunlight. She felt happy and contented, like a seal on a rock with her seal family around her. She was coming out of a dream, and all her friends were here with her. It was like the end of the Wizard of Oz. But the frightening thing was that she knew she was about to sink down into the dream again. It wasn't over. This was just a brief, lucid interval. The anesthetic was going to kick back in a second. The dream would take her, and she didn't know if she would ever wake up again. That was why, that night in the hotel, when everybody else was asleep, she found herself walking the halls. She wanted something. She wanted Pouncey. She knocked on his door. When he answered, she kissed him. And after she kissed him, they slept together. She wanted to feel like a human being, a creature of stormy, messy emotions, one more time, even if it was a slightly slutty human being. She'd slept with people in the past because she thought she should, like James, or to get something out of them that she needed, Jared, Warren, fill in your own examples. She didn't think she'd ever done it just because she wanted to before. It felt good. No, it felt fantastic. This was the way it was supposed to work. She seemed more into it than Pouncey did. When she'd first gotten a look at him that first day, she'd thought, aha, yes, let's not jump to any conclusions, but by all means, this could happen. She'd always gone for the clean-cut type, viz. James, and Pouncey fell well within the acceptable parameters. But whenever she looked into Pouncey's flat slate eyes and steeled herself for the drop as she fell for him, it never quite came. There wasn't quite enough of him there. There was someone in there. She knew there was. She could see him perfectly clearly when they were online. But when they were together in person, face to face, Pouncey retreated somewhere far below the surface, deep under the ice. His security was too tight to crack, even for a hacker of her credentials. She told Pouncey all this afterward, lying in bed with those cicadas still shrilling away outside, though thankfully muted by the shutters. For a long time he didn't answer. "I know," he said carefully. "I'm sorry." It was the easy answer, though at least he'd given it a shot.
"Don't be sorry. It doesn't matter."
It really didn't. They looked at the ceiling and listened to the cicadas some more. She felt pleasantly fleshly. She was mind and body both, for once.
"But just so I know, is that why you want this so much?" she asked, sitting up. "The power? Like, if one day you're that strong, then maybe you'll be safe enough that the rest of you can come out?"
"Maybe." He grimaced, incidentally showing off those interesting lines around his mouth. She traced one with her finger. "I don't know."
"You don't know, or you won't say?"
"Nothing." Blue screen of death. She'd crashed his system. Oh, well, boys were so unstable that way, full of buggy, self-contradictory code, pathetically unoptimized. She flopped back down on the thin hotel pillow.
"So where would you put Project Ganymede's chances of success?" she said, just making conversation now. "Percentage-wise?"
"Oh, I like our chances," Pouncey said, his personality, such as it was, coming back online now that he was back on safe ground.
"I'm going to go 70-30, us."
"You?"
"More like even Steven. 50-50. What are you going to do if it doesn't work out?"
"Try again, somewhere else. I still think Greece is ground zero for this stuff."
"Would you come if I did?" "Maybe."
She wasn't going to reassure him just for the sake of it. "The wine's better here, though. I'm not an ouzo girl." "That's what I like about you." He played with her fingers on top of the scratchy hotel blanket, studying them. "Listen, I lied before," he said. "I think I do know why I'm doing this, what's in it for me, or part of it. It's not about power for me, not really."
"Okay, what then?"
"This ought to be good." Julia propped herself up on an elbow, and the sheet slid down off her shoulders. It was strange to be naked in front of Pouncey after all the time they'd spent together clothed. It was strange to be naked in front of anybody. It was like that cold water out there in the bay. Scary. You didn't think you could stand it, but then you plunged in, and pretty soon you got used to it.
There was enough hiding in life. Sometimes you just wanted to show somebody your tits.
I was in Free Trader before you. You weren't there when I came in.
So?
So, to be crude about it, you haven't seen my prescriptions. Pouncey grinned ruefully, a different smile from his regular smile. In terms of raw dosage, I am the official all-time record holder for Free Trader Beowulf. At first, they didn't even think they were real.
And therefore, depression?
He nodded. Ever notice how I never drink coffee or eat chocolate? Can't. Not with this much Nardil in my system. I've had a half dozen courses of ECT. I tried to kill myself when I was 12. My brain chemistry, it's just hosed. Not viable in the long term. Now it was Julia who felt panicky. She wasn't good in these moments, and she knew it. Hesitantly, she put her hand on his smooth chest. It was all she could think of. It seemed to work well enough. God, did he actually manscape?
So you think Our Lady Underground can heal you? Like with asthma, that scar, whatever that was?
It was sinking in what he was saying. This wasn't an intellectual exercise for him, or a power grab.
I don't know. He said it lightly, like he didn't care. I really don't. It would be a miracle, and I guess miracles are OLU's business. But to be honest, I wasn't thinking of it that way. How then?
If you laugh, I swear to God that I will kill you.
Careful, she might be listening.
I'll plead insanity. I can back it up.
Pouncey's face wasn't a naturally expressive one. His cut cheekbones might have worked for a model if he'd been a little taller, but never for an actor.
But for a second, she could really see what he was feeling as he felt it.
I want her to take me home with her, he said. I want her to take me back with her into heaven.
Julia didn't laugh. She understood that she was looking at another person like herself, a broken person. But Pouncey was even more broken than she was.
She was used to feeling sorry for herself and angry at other people. She was less used to feeling sorry for someone else. But she felt it now. She would never be in love with Pouncey, but she felt love for him. I hope she does, Pouncey, she said. If that's what you want, I truly hope she does. But we'll miss you if you go.
Back at Mur, Julia did something she hadn't done since she'd gotten there in June. She went online. None of them had been on Free Trader Beowulf in ages. It took them a while to crack the new login routine, which changed every couple of months. They raced each other, alone in their bedrooms, but yelling trash talk back and forth. Except for Failstaff, who was too much the gentle giant to talk trash, which may have contributed to his eventual victory. Asmo quit early and futzed around hacking the router instead, so she could kick Pouncey offline at will. Once she was in, Julia didn't announce her presence. You didn't have to. You could slip in without the system pinging everybody. Because she didn't want a blizzard of IMs from free traders wanting to catch up after her long absence. For a couple of hours, she just lurked, cruising through old threads and new ones that had sprung up while she was offline. There had been some turnover in the membership. There were a couple of new fish, and a couple of old fish were gone or in hiding. It seemed like years since she'd been there. She felt so much older now. You could customize the free trader interface any number of ways, but Julia had always gone for a bare-bones look. ASCII characters only, approximating the look and feel of an old-timey Unix shell. Her eyes filled with tears just looking at everybody's usernames, picked out in green-on-black text. So much had changed since then, since she'd been living a life of quiet desperation in a mundane universe, racking up hours at the IT shop and killing time till she could take off for Stanford. So much that couldn't be changed back. But not much had changed here.
Pouncey, Asmo, and Failstaff were running a private thread, just like back in the day, she checked in. Vicious Circe has joined this thread. Pouncy Silver Kitten. Hey, VC.
Asmodeus.
Hey.
Failstaff.
Hey.
Vicious Circe.
Hey.
Electric silence for a minute, and then...
Asmodeus. So, big damn show tomorrow, huh?
Vicious Circe.
Maybe.
Failstaff.
Don't come much bigger.
Asmodeus. What do you mean, maybe?
Vicious Circe.
Big show if OLU shows up.
Asmodeus.
Why wouldn't she?
Vicious Circe. Vicious Circe.
She might not exist. The summoning might fail. She might be on the rag. There are 10K reasons why not. Just saying.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Yes, but what about the mirror, silver coins, milk, etc.?
Asmodeus.
And she fixed my scar.
Vicious Circe.
Yeah. Look, I don't want to be the asshole. Just, I've seen some serious major league spell work. No actual gods yet, though.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
But you do believe that there is a higher praxis.
Vicious Circe. Believe there might be. Equal why I'm still here.
Vicious Circe.
And anyway.
Vicious Circe.
What if OLU does come? What if she is real? What next? How does it go down? What if she won't teach us? I mean, do you want to just summon a god, or do you want to be a god?
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Be.
But this equal necessary first step.
Failstaff. But okay, good point, VC.
Maybe OLU isn't looking for interns.
Vicious Circe. Seriously, say she manifests tomorrow. How does the conversation go, Pouncy?
It was weird that they hadn't talked about this stuff openly before. What they would actually say and do if she came. Maybe it was easier to do it online than face to face. There was less pressure. The stakes seemed lower. Keep it casual.
Pouncy Silver Kitten. Since you ask, I've thought a lot about this.
Asmodeus.
You better have.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
So, ahem. Your standard issue god follows one of two protocols, right?
Failstaff.
Splain.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Protocol number one equal prayer. This is more your modern Christian deity. You pray for X. God listens, then judges you. If you're deemed worthy, good, whatever, you get what you prayed for. You get X. If not, then not.
Asmodeus.
Oops, I forgot to be good.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Now your ancient pagan deity follows protocol number two, more a basic, transactional kind of deal, demands a sacrifice in return for goods and services.
Failstaff.
Those were the days.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
And then the nature of the sacrifice itself follows one of two protocols, symbolic or real.
Asmodeus.
Testify, my brother!
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Number one, symbolic equals something you don't really need, but that signifies your devotion to the deity, a fatted calf or whatever, etc. Number two, real equals something you do need that proves your devotion to the deity, i.e. your hand, foot, blood, child, etc.
Vicious Circe.
Like Abraham and Isaac, sometimes God wants your son, sometimes he'll settle for a ram.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Exactly. That's my rough and ready take.
Vicious Circe.
Fine, so run the numbers, gents, and you get three different scenarios, and we're screwed 2 out of 3.
Vicious Circe.
Modern deity, we're screwed because we are presumably unworthy, hence our prayers go unanswered.
Vicious Circe.
Pagan deity number two, if she demands a real sacrifice, we're screwed because, hello, Pouncy, I need my foot or whatever.
Vicious Circe.
Pagan deity number one is our only shot, symbolic sacrifice, fatted calf in exchange for the divine praxis. 1 in 3, that's my take. Rough and ready.
Failstaff.
And sorry, but what if I really need my fatted calf? What then, P, what then?
Asmodeus.
Sorry, Pouncy, but do I really have to be the one to say that you have no fucking idea what you're talking about?
Asmodeus.
Literally none.
Pouncy Silver Kitten.
Oh, really?
Failstaff.
Question.
Vicious Circe. Asmodeus.
You think this is a male god you are dealing with, i.e. you writ large. Wrong. OLU is a goddess, a lady god. This is not about protocols.
Asmodeus.
I believe in Our Lady Underground, and I believe that she will help us, not because it is in her interest to do so, or because she wants to eat your fucking foot or whatever, but because she is kind. Pouncy, you twat.
Asmodeus.
This is not a transaction, bitches. This is about mercy. This is about forgiveness. This is about divine grace. If Our Lady comes, that is what will save us.
Long silence.
Dead air.
The next message was time-stamped a full 2 minutes later.
Pouncy Silver Kitten. So how about it, VC? Are you in or are you out or what are you?
Vicious Circe has left this thread.
They did it in the library. It was the only room big enough. They'd had to pack up all the books and stack them in the long study and elsewhere. The halls were overflowing with them, and dismantle those beautiful floating shelves. The walls were bare, the way they would have been when this was a farmhouse. The windows were flung open to the cold, quiet, late autumn air. The early evening sky was an unnaturally amazing blue, almost a royal blue. It was all arranged very precisely according to ex-Saint Amador's Phoenician invocation, down to the letter. The floor was a maze of chalk runes and patterns. Gummidji would take the role of mistress of ceremonies and high priestess. Any of them could have handled the technicalities, but it had to be a woman, and of the women, dour, towering Gummidji was the player deemed least likely to crack up at a crucial moment. She wore a simple, flowing, white gown. So did everybody else. Gummidji also wore a crown of mistletoe.
So your basic golden bough deal, Julia thought. Fucking mistletoe. She never saw what all the fuss was about. Sure, it's pretty enough, but at the end of the day it's still a botanical parasite that strangles its host. All the old furniture had been exiled from the room. In its place there was only a thick yew table, constructed to exacting specifications, and a huge hewn stone altar that would have cracked the floor if they hadn't braced it up from below and put some structural spells on the brace. The entire place had been purified in half a dozen ways, as had they. They'd fasted and then drunk some nasty teas that made their pee change color and smell weird, and burned herbs in clay pots. They'd done just about everything but actually bathe. The purification was symbolic, not hygienic. Actual medical hygiene didn't seem to be of great interest to the goddess.
"This isn't a patriarchal Old Testament show," Asmodeus said sharply when people complained. "Get it? Dirt does not contaminate. It generates. OLU doesn't care if we're menstruating. She embraces the body."
This was followed by ribald witticisms from the menfolk, signifying their willingness to offer themselves as symbolic husbands to the goddess.
"I got your chthonic sacrifice right here in my pants," etc., etc.
But Asmodeus's famous sense of humor was temporarily in remission for the occasion. Maybe it was nerves. Asmodeus wasn't high priestess material, but she seemed to have appointed herself the goddess's chief political compliance officer. She'd even argued that they should all go off their various medications for the occasion, too, a suggestion that was universally ridiculed. The yew table supported 3 beeswax candles and a big silver bowl full of rainwater. The bowl had cost about as much as the entire swimming pool had. The stone, a massive block of local marble, supported nothing. To be honest, they weren't totally sure what it was for. Gummidji took her place before the table while the others stood along the walls on either side, four and five. It was asymmetrical, but there was nothing specifically against it in Amadur's palimpsest, which was otherwise pretty lucid for a document prepared by a guy who lived in a cave and was pushing 2 millennia, at least. Julia's mind was a hot, churning mix of excitement and nerves, which she kept from boiling over with lashings of cool skepticism. But she remembered the rough, stiff feel of the statue's kiss in her dream. As creepy and Freudian as it sounded, she had felt so loved. She'd hoped she'd dream it again last night, but there had been nothing, just dead air. Pouncey was to her left. Asmodeus and Failstaff were opposite her, so she could see them, but she avoided their eyes. They needed a full hour of silence before the summoning could begin, and tittering had to be kept to an absolute minimum. From outside, they could hear the lowing and bleating of the sacrificial animals they'd brought in for the occasion, 2 sheep, 2 goats, and 2 calves, one of each pure black and all white, all shampooed within an inch of their imminently endangered lives. Should a symbolic sacrifice be required, they wanted to make sure the cupboard wasn't bare. By 7 o'clock, the sun was down and the moon was on the rise, lipping up over the hills and fields behind Mur. Once it cleared the trees, a huge white arc light that seemed to be trained on their house alone, Gummidji moved from her station in the center of the room and lit their candles one by one with the tip of her finger. Julia angled her candle so the wax wouldn't run down it and onto her hand. A hot droplet pricked her bare foot. Gummidji returned to the table and began the invocation. Somehow the candles on the table had been lit in the meantime, without anybody noticing. Julia was glad it wasn't her in the hot seat. For one thing, the invocation was long, and who knew what would happen if you munged it. Maybe it would just fizzle, but maybe it would snap back at you. Some spells did that. For another, it wasn't a spell, exactly. There was a lot of beseeching in it, and in Julia's opinion, a magician did not beseech, she commanded. The grammar of it was all weird, too. It kept repeating and circling back on itself, working through the same phrases over and over again. Frankly, it sounded like junk to Julia. There was no proper structure to it, just a lot of talk about mothers and daughters and grain and earth and honey and wine, all that Song of Solomon stuff. But it wasn't bullshit. That was the really crazy thing. Gummidji was getting traction with this crap. Julia couldn't see anything. There were no visual phenomena, but she didn't have to. It was blindingly obvious that magic was happening. Gummidji's voice was getting deeper and more echoey. Certain words made the air vibrate or caused sudden rushes of wind. Julia's candle started flaring up like a torch. She wished it wouldn't. She had to hold it at arm's length to keep it from singeing her hair, which she had left loose because it had seemed more feminine and OLU-like. Something was happening. Something was on its way. She could feel it coming like a freight train. It was only then that Julia realized something, something absolutely terrible that it would have been hard to admit to Pouncey or the others, even if it weren't too late. She didn't want it to work. She wanted the spell to fail. She had made a grave mistake. She had misunderstood something about herself, something so basic she couldn't understand how she'd missed it until now. She didn't need this, and she didn't want it. She didn't want the goddess to come. Pouncey had told her when she first got to Mur that it wasn't enough for her to love him and the others. She had to love magic more. But she didn't. She came to Mur looking for magic, but she was also looking for a new home and a new family. And she'd found them all 3. And it was enough. She was content. She didn't need anything else, least of all more power. Her quest had ended, and she hadn't even known it till this moment.
She didn't want to become a goddess. All she'd wanted was to become human, and here at Mur it had finally happened.
Now it was too late.
She couldn't stop what was happening. The goddess was coming. She wanted to throw down her candle and run around the room shouting at them, breaking up the flow, telling them it was okay, they didn't have to do this, they had all they needed right there all around them if they could only see it. Our Lady Underground would understand that. OLU, goddess of mercy and fruitfulness, she above all would understand what Julia had only just figured out.
But there was no way Julia could make the others understand. And there were titanic energies in the room with them now, giant forces, and there was no telling what would happen if she tried to disrupt the casting. Julia's whole body was goosebumps. Gummy G's voice was getting louder. She was building up to the big finish. Her eyes were closed, and she was swaying from side to side and singing. It wasn't in the invocation. The melody must have come to her straight over the transom, out of the ether, via the heavenly wireless. The windows on one side of the room were solid moonlight now, as if the moon had come down from its orbit and was hovering right outside, peering in at them.
It was hard to tear her eyes away from Gummidgee, but Julia risked a glance to her left at Pouncey. He looked back at her and smiled. He wasn't nervous. He looked calm. He looked happy. "Please, if nothing else, please let her give him what he needs," she thought. Julia clung to this truth, that OLU would never ask them for something they couldn't give. Julia knew her, and she would never do that. One of the candles on the table had started to spit and crackle and flare. It produced a gout of flame, a big one that went halfway up to the ceiling and made a deep, guttural woof, and then it spat out something huge and red that landed standing on the table. Gummidgee gave a choking cough and dropped to the floor like she'd been shot. Julia could hear the crack as her head hit. In the sudden silence, the god struck a triumphant pose, arms wide, and held it. It was a giant, 12 feet tall and lithe and covered with red hair. It had the shape of a man and the head of a fox. It was not Our Lady Underground. It was Reynard the fox. They'd been tricked, but good. "Shit!" It was Asmodeus's voice. Always quick was Asmo. In the same moment came the rifle shot of all the windows slamming shut at once, and the door as if something invisible had just left in an almighty huff. The moonlight went out like a switch had been flipped. Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God! The fear was instant and electric. Her whole body was almost spasming with it. They'd stuck out their thumbs and they had gotten into the wrong car. They'd been tricked just the way OLU had been in the story, tricked and sent to the underworld, if she even existed at all. Maybe she didn't. Maybe it was all just a joke. Julia threw her candle at the fox. It bounced off his leg and went out. She pictured Reynard the fox as a playful, sprightly figure. He was not that. He was a monster, and they were shut in here with him. Reynard jumped lightly down from the table, a carnival showman. Now that he had moved, she found she could move, too. She was crap at offensive magic, but she knew her shields, and she knew some sledgehammer dismissals and banishments. Just in case, she began piling up wards and shields between herself and the god, so thick that the air turned amber and wavy, tinted glass and heat ripples. Next to her, she could hear Pouncey, still calm, preparing a banishment. The situation was salvageable. It didn't work, so let's get rid of this shithead and get out of here. Let's go to Greece. There was hardly any time. Reynard's mouth was a nest of pointy teeth. That's the thing about those tricksters, isn't it? They're never really all that fucking funny. She knew if he went for her, if he even looked at her, she would drop whatever she was casting and run, even though there was nowhere to run to. She stuttered twice, her voice broke, and she had to start a spell over. It must have been a trick all along. It was sinking in. There never was an Our Lady Underground at all, was there? She didn't exist. It made Julia want to weep with terror and sorrow.
The fox was looking around him, counting his winnings. Falstaff, oh, Falstaff, made the first move, advancing on him from behind, soft-footed for a big man. He'd amped up his candle into something like a flamethrower and was aiming it two-handed. Big as he was, he looked tiny next to a real giant. He'd barely got the thing flaming when Reynard turned suddenly, grabbed his robe and pulled him over with one huge hand and put him in the crook of his arm like he was going to give him a Dutch rub. But he didn't give him a Dutch rub. He broke Falstaff's neck like a farmer killing a hen and dropped him on the floor. He lay on top of Gummidgee, who still hadn't moved. His legs shook like he was being electrocuted. All the breath went out of Julia's chest and got stuck there. She couldn't inhale. She was going to pass out. At the other end of the room, a party of three was already going at the door, trying to unseal it. They were working together, Iris in the middle, big magic, six-handed. Warming to his task, humming what might have been a jolly Provençal folk song, Reynard hefted the big block of stone with both hands and heaved it into them. Two of them went down hard under it. The third, it was Fiberpunk, the metamagician, him of the four-dimensional shapes, kept gamely at it, ice-cold under fire, taking all three parts himself without dropping a stitch. Julia always thought he must be a bit of a fraud with all that shit he talked, but he had chops. He was rattling off some sick, self-reflexive unlocking sequence like it was no big thing. Reynard took him with his two big hands around the chest like a doll and threw him up against the ceiling 30 feet up. He hit hard. Maybe Reynard was trying to make him stick, but he was probably still alive when his head clipped the table on the way down. His skull burst like a cantaloupe, spilling a fan of bloody slurry across the smooth parquet. Julia thought of all the metamagical secrets that must have been locked in that orderly brain, now catastrophically, irreversibly disordered. It was all over now, all ruined. Julia was ready to die now. She just hoped it wouldn't hurt too much. Reynard squatted and put his hands in the blood and whatever else, and smeared it sensually on his luxurious fox-fur chest, matting it. You couldn't tell if he was grinning like a mad thing, or if that's just how fox's mouth looked. 2 minutes after the fox god arrived, Pouncey, Asmodeus, and Julia were the last of the Mure magicians, the cream of the safe house scene, left alive on the planet. For a moment, Julia felt her feet leave the floor. It must have been Pouncey trying to buy them a minute by taking them up to that high ceiling, but Reynard cut the spell off when they were only a couple of feet off the floor, and they dropped back down hard. He picked up the heavy silver bowl, dumping out the rainwater, and threw it at Pouncey like a discus. Just as he did, Asmodeus finished up something she'd been working on since the god arrived— a maximal dismissal, maybe, with a little something extra on it, something sharp, that actually tweaked Reynard's attention. It didn't hurt him, but he felt it. You could see his big pointy ears twitch with annoyance. The cup struck Pouncey hard, but off-center it crunched his left hip and went rocketing away. Pouncey groaned and folded in two. "Stop!" Julia said. "Stop it!" Fear. Julia was all out of it. A dead woman didn't feel fear, and she was all out of magic, too. She was going to say some regular words for a change, non-magic words. She was going to talk to this asshole. "You took our sacrifice," she said. She swallowed. "Now give us what we paid for." It felt like she was trying to breathe at 30,000 feet. The fox looked down his narrow muzzle at her. With his doggy head and human body, he looked like the Egyptian death god Anubis. "Give it to us," Julia shouted. "You owe it to us." Asmo watched her from the other side of the room, frozen. All her knowing, savvy Asmo attitude had fallen away. She looked about 10 years old. Reynard gave a loud bark before he spoke. A sacrifice is not to be taken, he said in a deep, reasonable voice with only a very slight French accent. A sacrifice is to be freely given. I took their lives. They did not offer them to me.
It was like he couldn't believe the rudeness of it.
I had to take them.
Pouncey had pushed himself up into a sitting position against the wall. The pain must have been appalling. Sweat stood out all over his face.
Take my life. I'm giving it to you. Take it.
Reynard cocked his head.
Fantastic, Mr. Fox.
He fingered his whiskers.
You are dying. You will be dead soon. It is not the same.
You can have mine, Julia said. I'm giving it to you, if you let the others live. Reynard groomed himself, licking blood and brains off the back of his paw hand.
Do you know what you have done here? He said. I am just the beginning. When you call on a god, all gods hear. Did you know that? And no human has called down a god in 2,000 years. The old gods will have heard too, you know. Better to be dead when they come back. Better never to have lived when the old gods return.
Take me, Pouncey moaned. He gasped as something inside him gave way, and he whispered the rest.
Take me. I'm giving you my life.
You are dying, Reynard said again, dismissively. He paused. Pouncey said nothing.
He has died, Reynard announced.
The fox god turned to Julia and raised his eyebrows, studying her. A real fox wouldn't have those, Julia thought meaninglessly.
I accept, he said.
The other one can live if you give yourself to me, and I will give you something more. I will give you what you wanted, what you summoned me for.
We didn't summon you, Asma said in a small voice. We summoned Our Lady.
Then she bit her lip and fell silent. Reynard regarded Julia critically, and then he went for her. He went right through her wards like they weren't there. Julia was ready to die. She closed her eyes and let her head fall back, baring her throat for him to rip it out. But he didn't. His hairy hands were on her. He dragged her across the room and forced her upper body down so she was bent over the yew table. Julia didn't understand, and then she did, and she wished she hadn't. She fought him. He pinned her torso down on the wood with one hard, heavy hand, and she tore at his fingers, but they were like stone. She had agreed, but she hadn't agreed to this. Let him kill her if he wanted. It hurt when he tore her robe off. The fabric burned against her skin. She tried to look behind her at what was happening, and she saw... No, she didn't see that. She saw nothing. The god's big hand working casually between his legs as he positioned himself behind her. He kicked her bare feet apart with a practiced kick. This wasn't his first time at the rodeo. Then he pushed himself inside her. She had wondered if he would be too big, if he would tear her open and leave her gutted and flopping like a fish. She strained against him. Exhausted, she rested her hot forehead on her arm in what she supposed was the manner of rape victims since the beginning of time. Her own hoarse panting was the only sound. It took a long time. It was not a timeless period. She didn't pass out or lose track of time. She would have said it took between 7 and 10 minutes for the god to finish raping her, and she was there for every second of it. From her vantage point, she could see Falstaff's thick legs on the floor, not moving anymore, overlapping Gummidgee's long brown ones, and she could see where the two who had died by the door lay, a huge continent of blood having flowed out from under the stone block and joined into one shape.
Better me than Asmo. She couldn't see Asmodeus because she couldn't look at her, but she could hear her. She was crying loudly. She sounded like the little girl she still essentially was, a little girl who had lost her way. Where was home for her? Who were her parents? Julia didn't even know. Hot tears flowed down Julia's cheeks, too, and slicked her arm and wet the brown wood. The only other noises were those made by Reynard the Fox, the trickster god, grunting softly and hoarsely behind her. At one point, a couple of rebel nerve endings attempted to send pleasure signals to her brain, whereupon her brain burned them out with a pulse of neurochemical electricity, never to feel again. Before he was done with Julia, Asmodeus doubled over and threw up, splat, on the floor. Then she ran, slipping once on vomit, once again on blood. She reached the door, and it opened for her. It took a long time to close behind her. Through it, and through a window across the hall, Julia caught a glimpse of the innocent, green-black world outside, impossibly far away. The fox god barked loudly when he came. She felt it. The terrible, unspeakable thing, which she would never tell anybody, not even herself, was that it felt wonderful. Not in a sexual way, God no. But it filled her up with power. It flowed into every part of her, up through her trunk, down her legs, and out through her arms. She clenched her teeth and shut her eyes to try and stop it. But it even reached her brain, lighting her up from within with divine energy. She opened her eyes and watched it fill her hands. When it reached the tips of her fingernails glowed. And then he took something from her. As he withdrew his penis from her, something came out with it. It was like it caught on something, a transparent film, it felt like, something inside her, the same shape as her. It was something invisible that had been with her always, and Reynard ripped it away. She didn't know what it was, but she felt it go, and she shuddered when she felt it. Without it, she was something different, something other than what she had been before. Reynard had given her power and taken something in payment that she would have died rather than give up. But she didn't get to choose.
Finally, it might have been 10 minutes later, she raised her head. The moon was back up in the sky where it belonged, as if it were blameless and had taken no part in this. It was just a regular moon now, a sterile rock, frozen and suffocated to death in the vacuum, that was all. Julia stood up and turned around. She looked at Pouncey. He was still sitting up against the wall, steely eyes still open, but very definitely dead. Maybe he was in heaven now. She knew she should feel something, but she felt nothing, and that in itself was horrifying. She walked to the door and out through it, her bare feet splatting lightly in the cool blood. She didn't look back. All the lights were off. The house was empty. Nobody home. Thinking and feeling nothing, because there was nothing left to think or feel except the unpleasant stickiness of blood and God knew what else on her feet and between her toes, she stepped out onto the lawn. Something terrible has happened, she thought, but no emotions attached to those words. The sacrificial animals were all gone, escaped somehow and fled, except for the two sheep, who wouldn't meet her eyes. For some reason, the sun was coming up. They must have been in there all night. She rubbed her feet in the cold dew, then bent down and put her hands in it and rubbed them on her face. Then she uttered a word she had never heard before and flew, naked and bloody as a newborn baby, up into the lightening sky. Chapter 26 The others had stayed out on the beach until dawn, waiting for Quentin and Julia to come back up from the underworld.
Finally, they'd given up and gone back to their berths aboard the Muntjac, chilled and exhausted, to sleep. When they woke up a few hours later, they were relieved and then overjoyed to find Quentin and Julia waiting for them on deck. Though the scene they woke up to was a weird one. Julia stood there transformed, newly beautiful and powerful. She radiated an air of peace and triumph. Quentin wasn't transformed, but something else was going on with him. He was down on his hands and knees for some reason, just staring at the wooden planks of the deck. They had flown up and up and up until gradually Quentin realized that the weightless feeling he had was of them descending instead, but not the way they had come. They dropped down through wet, clinging clouds, and then he saw a little chip of wood below them in the ocean that turned out to be the Muntjac, the water around it glittering with dawn light. The goddess placed them on the deck, kissed Julia on the cheek, and vanished. Quentin found that he couldn't stand on his own. Or he could, but he didn't want to. He got down on all fours and put the key down in front of him. He looked at the good wooden planks the Muntjac was made of, really looked at them. After a night spent in hell, everything was real and vivid and impossibly detailed. Colors looked super bright, even the grays and browns and blacks and the other undistinguished intermediate non-colors that he ordinarily would have skipped over and ignored. He followed the lines and striations and tiger stripes of the wood, drawn and arranged with careless perfection, dark and light, order and chaos, all mingled together with little splinters along the edges of the boards that had been scuffed up and set at different angles, each one by the passage of careless feet. He absolutely understood how weird and high-seeming he looked, but he didn't care. He felt like he could stare at the wood forever. Just this, the good, hardy, noble wood. He was never going to lose this, he thought. He was going to enjoy everything exactly as much to the atom as Benedict would have enjoyed it if he could have come back from the underworld, and Alice, and all the rest of them. It was all he could do for them. Earth or Fillory, did it even matter? What was the huge conundrum? Everywhere you looked, there was so much richness, you could never exhaust it. Maybe it was all a game that got crumpled up and thrown away at the end, but while you were here, it was real. He pressed his forehead against the deck, hard, like a penitent pilgrim, and felt the beat of the waves transmitted through it from below like a pulse, and the heat of the sun. He smelled the sour salt smell of seawater, and he heard the hesitant footsteps of baffled people gathering around him, unsure of what to do. He heard all the other meaningless noises reality was always cheerfully making to itself, the squeaks and scrapes and thumps and drones, on and on, world without end. He took a deep breath and sat up. Away from the warmth of the goddess's body, he shivered in the early morning ocean air. But even the cold felt good to him. "This is life," he kept saying to himself. "That was being dead, and this is being alive. That was death. This is life. I will never confuse them again." Then people were hauling him to his feet and guiding him down below to his cabin. He was pretty sure he could have walked on his own, but he let them half carry him. They seemed to want to do it, and who was he to stand in their way? Then he was lying on his side on his bed. He was dead tired, but he didn't want to close his eyes, not with everything that was going on all around him. Sometime later, he felt someone sit down on the edge of the bed. Julia. "Thank you, Julia," he said after a while. His lips and tongue felt thick and clumsy. "You saved me. You saved everything. Thank you." "The goddess saved us. I'm grateful to her, too. I'll tell her." "How do you feel?"
"I feel finished," she said simply. "I feel like I am finally finished. I became who I was becoming." Oh, he said, and he had to laugh at how completely stupid he sounded. I'm just glad you're all right. Are you all right? I was stuck in between for so long, she said, instead of answering his question. I couldn't go back. I wanted to for a long time. A long time. I wanted to go back to before what happened when I was still human, but I couldn't. And I couldn't go forward either. Then somehow in the underworld, I realized for the first time, really understood, that I was never going back. So I let go, and that's when it happened.
He felt tongue-tied. What do you say to a newly minted supernatural being? He wanted to just stare at her. He'd never been in such close quarters with a spirit before. You said you were a dryad.
I am. We're the daughters of the goddess. That makes me a demigoddess, she added by way of clarification. I'm not literally her daughter, of course. It's more of a spiritual thing.
Julia was still Julia, but the anger, the sense that she was violently at odds with the world over some crucial point, was gone, and she'd gotten her contractions back.
So you take care of trees? We take care of the trees, and the goddess takes care of us. There's a tree that belongs to me, though. I'm not sure what it is. I can feel it, though. I'll go there as soon as we're done.
She laughed. It was good to know she still could. I know so much about oak trees. I could bore you to death with it. Do you know I had almost lost faith in the goddess? I almost stopped believing in her?
But I realized I had to become something. I had to take what was done to me and use it to make myself into what I wanted to be. And I wanted this. And when I called her, the goddess came.
I feel so powerful, Quentin. It's like there is a sun inside me or a star that will burn forever.
Does that mean... are you immortal?
I don't know.
And here a cloud passed over her face.
In a way... I've already died. Julia is dead, Quentin. I'm alive, and I may be alive forever, but the girl I was is dead.
Sitting this close to Julia, he could see how inhuman she was now. Her flesh was like pale wood. The girl he'd known in high school, with her freckles and her oboe, was gone forever. She'd been destroyed and discarded in the making of this being. Julia would never be mortal again. The Julia sitting next to him on his bed was like a magnificent memorial to the girl she used to be. At least this Julia was beyond all that. She was out of the game, the living and dying game, that the rest of them were trapped in. She was different. She wasn't kludgy, rickety, flesh and blood anymore. She was magic.
There are things you should know, she said.
I can tell you now how all this began, why I changed, and why the old gods came back.
Really? Quentin propped himself up on one elbow. You know?
I know, she said. I'm going to tell you everything.
I want to know.
It's not a happy story.
I think I'm ready. He said, I know you think that, but it's sadder than you think. There were no more islands. They were past that now. The Muntjac slid its way through calm, empty ocean, day after day, farther and farther east, the sun rising in front of them, roaring by overhead, and then extinguishing itself nightly in the water behind them. It was visibly larger in the mornings.
They could almost hear the muffled rumble of its burning, like a distant blast furnace.
After a week, the wind died, but the sky was clear, and in the afternoons and evenings, Admiral Lacker raised the light sail, and they ran along on the strength of a storm of sunshine. Quentin had been to the far west of Fillory when he hunted the white stag over the western sea, but the far east was a very different place.
It had a polar quality. The sun was bright and hot here, but the air was getting colder. Even in the mornings, when the sun seemed dangerously close, like it was going to light the mast on fire, they could see their breath. The blue of the sky was deep and vivid. It felt like